Becky. She flops onto my shoulder, knees buckling.
Don't be sad. Promise me, Tori. Promise me. Promise me you won't be sad anymore.
I promise. I have to. I hate Jack. He is such a bitch.
I deserve someone like Ben. He is so beautiful. Like you. You hate everything, but you're still beautiful. You're a ghost. I love you so much. So much. Don't sad anymore.
I don't really want to leave her because she is beyond drunk, but I need to get home. Michael actually pushes me forward, and we abandon Becky, whose legs look too spindly now, her makeup too thick, her hair too backcombed. Michael is running, and so am I. He gets on his bike. It's a real bicycle. Do people even ride these anymore?
Get on the back, he says.
You are joking, I say. It's that or walk. I get on the back. And with that, Sherlock Holmes and Wednesday Adams fly into the night. He's cycling so fast that the houses we pass blur into grey and brown wavy lines, and I'm clinging onto his waist so tight that my fingers have lost feeling. I realize that I'm happy, even though I shouldn't be, and the conflicting emotion only makes the moment more insane, more radiant, more immeasurable. The air tears at my face and makes my eyes water, and I lose track of where we are, even though I know this town inside out. And all I can think of is that this might have been what that boy who flew away with E.T. felt like. Like, I could die right now, and it wouldn't matter. We're at my house within 15 minutes. Michael doesn't come inside. He has manners, I'll give him that. He sits up on the bike as I look back at him. I hope he's all right, he says. I nod. He nods and cycles away. I unlock the door and enter my house. Chapter 13. Oliver trots sleepily down the stairs. Thomas the Tank Engine pajamas, Teddy in his arm. I'm glad that he's never understood what's wrong with Charlie. You all right, Oliver?
Yeah.
You gonna go to bed?
What about Charlie?
He'll be fine. Leave it all to me. Oliver nods and ambles back up the stairs, rubbing his eyes. I rush toward the kitchen door, which is closed. I feel sick. I'm not even fully awake. Charlie! I knock on the door. Total silence. I attempt to get in, but he's blocked it with something.
Open the door, Charles. I'm not joking. I'll break the door.
No, you won't.
His voice is dead. Empty. But I'm relieved because he's alive. I turn the handle down and push with my whole body.
Don't come in!
He sounds panicked, which makes me panicked because Charlie is never panicked, and that is what makes him Charlie.
Don't come in here, please!
There's a clattering of things being frantically moved around. I keep heaving my body onto the door, and whatever is blocking it begins to move away. I make a gap large enough for me to slip inside, and I do.
No, go away, leave me alone.
I look at him.
Get out!
He's been crying. His eyes are dark red and purple, and the darkness of the room drowns him in a haze. There is a plate of lasagna on the kitchen table, cold, untouched. All of our food has been removed from the cupboards, and the fridge, and the freezer, and set out in order of size and colour in various piles around the room. There are a couple of blood-stained tissues in his hands. He's not. Better.
I'm sorry, he croaks, slumped in a chair, head rolled backward, eyes vacant. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I'm sorry.
I can't do anything. It's hard not to throw up.
I'm sorry, he keeps saying. I'm so sorry.
Where's Nick? I say. Why is he not with you?
He goes deep red and then mumbles something inaudible.
What?
We argued. He left.
I start shaking my head. It goes from left to right to left to right in an uncontrollable act of defiance. That bastard, that stupid bastard.
No, Victoria, it was my fault.
My phone is in my hand and I'm punching in Nick's number.
Hello? Do you understand the severity of what you have done, you absolute prick?
Tori, what are you?
If Oliver hadn't called me, Charlie might have.
I can't even say it.
This is entirely your fault.
I'm not. Wait, what the hell's happened?
What the hell do you think has happened? You left Charlie during a mealtime. You can't do that. You can't do that. You can't leave him while he's eating, let alone upset him. Didn't you learn that last year?
I didn't. I trusted you.
You were supposed to look after him, and now I've walked into the kitchen and he's... I shouldn't have gone out. I should have been here.
I'm the person who is supposed to be there when this happens.
Wait, what? I'm holding the phone so tight I'm shaking. Charlie is looking at me, silent tears falling from his eyes.
He is so old now.
He's not a little kid. In a couple of months he'll be 16 like me.
He looks older than me, for God's sake. He could pass for 18, easy.
I drop the phone, draw up a chair next to my brother, and put my arms around him. Nick gets here, and with Charlie we clear up the kitchen. Charlie keeps wincing and clutching his head as I upset all his precious piles of tins and packets, but I do it anyway because his psychiatrist told us that you have to be brutal. He used to shout at me when I moved his food around. Sometimes he'd try to physically stop me. He doesn't do that anymore. I get rid of the lasagna. I find the first aid kit and put plasters on Charlie's arm. Luckily, the cuts aren't deep enough to need stitches this time. I set the table and I make 3 rounds of beans on toast, and the three of us sit down. It's a difficult meal. Charlie doesn't want to eat anything. His knees keep bobbing up and down, and his fork keeps reaching his mouth and stopping, unwilling to go any farther. Sometimes, in the hospital, they'd let him drink this extremely high-calorie drink instead of eating a meal. We don't have any of that in our house. I try not to shout at Charlie because that will make everything worse. Eventually, Nick and I escort him to bed.
I'm sorry, says Charlie, lying in bed with his arm across his forehead.
I'm standing at the doorway. Nick is on the floor in Charlie's spare pyjamas, which are much too small for him, with a spare duvet and pillow. He is staring at Charlie with an expression somehow simultaneously encompassing fear and love. I haven't forgiven him yet, but I know that he will redeem himself. I know that he cares about Charlie a lot.
I know, I say. But I'm going to have to tell Mum and Dad.
I know.
I'll come back and check on you in a bit.
Okay.
I stand there. After a while, he says, Are you okay?
An odd question, in my opinion. He is the one who just... I'm completely fine. I turn out the light and go downstairs and call Dad. He stays calm. Too calm. I don't like it. I want him to freak out and shout and panic, but he doesn't. He tells me that they'll come home right away. I put the phone down, pour a glass of diet lemonade, and sit in the living room for a while. It's the middle of the night. The curtains are all open. You do not find many people like Charlie Spring in the world. I suppose I have implied this already. You especially do not find many people like Charlie Spring at all boys' schools. If you want my opinion, all boys' schools sound like hell. Maybe it's because I don't know many boys. Maybe it's because I get a pretty bad impression of the guys I see coming out of the Truham gates, pouring fizzy drinks into one another's hair, calling one another gay and bullying gingers. I don't know. I don't know anything about Charlie's life at that school. I head back upstairs and peer into Charlie's room. He and Nick are now both fast asleep in Charlie's bed, Charlie curled into Nick's chest. I shut the door. I go to my room. I start shaking again, and I look at myself in the mirror for a long time and begin to wonder if I really am Wednesday Adams. I remember finding Charlie in the bathroom that time. There was a lot more blood then. It's very dark in my room, but my open laptop screen acts as a dim blue lamp. I pace around in circles, around and around, until my feet hurt. I put on some Bon Iver, and then some Muse, and then some Noah and the Whale. You know, really dumb, angsty stuff. I cry, and then I don't. There's a text on my phone, but I don't read it. I listen to the dark. They're all coming to get you. Your heartbeats are footsteps. Your brother is psychotic. You don't have any friends. Nobody feels bad for you. Beauty and the Beast isn't real. It's funny, because it's true. Don't be sad anymore. Don't be sad anymore. Chapter 14. 2:02 p.m. Michael Holden calling. Hello? I didn't wake you up, did I? Michael? No. Good. Sleep is important. How did you get my number? You called me, remember? Back in the IT room, I saved your number. That's very sneaky of you. I'd call it resourceful. Did you call about Charlie? I called about you. Is Charlie okay?
My parents took him to the hospital today for tests and stuff.
Where are you?
In bed.
At 2 in the afternoon?
Yeah.
Could I...
What?
Could I come over?
Why?
I don't like the thought of you there on your own. You remind me of an old person who lives alone, like with cats and daytime television.
Oh, really?
And I am a friendly young chap who would like to pop over so you can reminisce about the war and share some tea and biscuits.
I don't like tea.
But you like biscuits. Everyone likes biscuits.
I'm not in a biscuit mood today.
Well, I'm still coming over, Tori.
You don't have to come over. I'm completely fine.
Don't lie.
He is coming over. I don't bother changing out of my pyjamas or brushing my hair or seeing if my face actually looks human. I don't care. I don't get out of bed, even though I'm hungry, accepting the fact that my unwillingness to get up will probably result in my death from starvation.
Then I realise that I can't possibly let my parents have two children who knowingly starve themselves. Oh God, dilemma. Even lying in bed is stressful. The doorbell rings and makes my decision for me. I stand on the porch with one hand on the open door. He stands on the top step, looking much too preppy and much too tall, with his hair side-parted and his glasses stupidly large. His bike is chained to our fence. I hadn't noticed last night that it actually has a basket on it. It's minus a billion degrees, but he's just in a t-shirt and jeans again. He looks at me up and down. Oh dear. I go to shut the door on him, but he holds it open with one hand. I can't stop him after that. He just grabs me. His arms wrap around me. His chin rests on my head. My arms are trapped at my sides, and my cheek is sort of squashed into his chest. The wind twirls around us, but I'm not cold. He makes me a cup of tea. I hate tea, for God's sake. We drink out of faded mugs at the kitchen table. He asks me, "What do you normally do on Saturdays? Do you go out?" "Not if I can help it," I say. "What do you do?" "I don't really know." I take a sip of the dirty water. "You don't know?" He leans back. "Time passes. I do stuff. Some of it matters. Some of it doesn't." "I thought you were an optimist," he grins. "Just because something doesn't matter doesn't mean it's not worth doing." The light in our kitchen is off. It is very dark. "So, where shall we go today?" I shake my head. "I can't go out. Oliver's here." He blinks at me. "Oliver?" I wait for him to remember, but he doesn't. "My 7-year-old brother, I did tell you I had two brothers." He blinks again. "Oh, yeah. Yeah, you did." He's really quite excited. "Is he like you? Can I meet him?" Sure. I call Oliver, and he comes downstairs after a minute or so with a tractor in one hand, still with his pyjamas and dressing gown on. The dressing gown has tiger ears on the hood. He stands on the stairs, leans over the banister, and stares into the kitchen. Michael introduces himself, of course, with a wave and a blinding smile. "Hello, I'm Michael." Oliver introduces himself too, with equal vigour. "My name's Oliver Jonathan Spring," he says, waving his tractor around. "And this is Tractor Tom." He holds Tractor Tom to his ear and listens before continuing. "Tractor Tom does not think that you're dangerous, so you're allowed to go into the living room tractor if you want." "I would be absolutely delighted to visit the living room tractor," says Michael. I think he's a little surprised. Oliver is nothing like me whatsoever. Oliver studies him with judging eyes. After a moment's contemplation, he holds a hand up to his mouth and whispers loudly to me,
"Is he your boyfriend?"
This actually makes me laugh. Out loud. A real laugh. Michael laughs too, and then stops and looks at me while I continue smiling. I don't think he's seen me laugh before. Has he seen me smile properly before? He doesn't say anything. He just looks. And that is how the rest of my Saturday comes to be spent with Michael Holden. I didn't bother changing. Michael invades our kitchen cupboards and teaches me how to make chocolate cake. And then we eat chocolate cake for the rest of the day. Michael cuts the cake into cubes, not slices, and when I query him on this, he simply replies, "I don't like to conform to typical cake-cutting convention." Oliver keeps running up and downstairs, showing Michael his large and varied collection of tractors, in which Michael takes a politely enthusiastic interest. I have a nap in my room between 4 p.m. and 5 p.m., while Michael lies on the floor
and reads Metamorphosis. When I wake up, he tells me why the main character isn't really the main character, or something like that, and also how he didn't like the ending, because the supposed main character dies. Then he apologizes for spoiling the ending for me. I remind him I don't read. After that, the three of us clamber inside the living room tractor and play this old board game called Game of Life that Michael found under my bed. You receive all this money, sort of like Monopoly, and then the object of the game appears to be to have the most successful life, the best job, the highest income, the biggest house, the most insurance. It's a very odd game. Anyway, that takes up about 2 hours, and after another round of cake, we play Sonic Heroes on the PS2. Oliver triumphantly beats us both, and I have to give him a piggyback for the rest of the evening as a result. Once I put him to bed, I make Michael watch the Royal Tenenbaums with me. He cries when Luke Wilson slits his wrists. We both cry when Luke Wilson and Gwyneth Paltrow decide they have to keep their love a secret. It is 10 o'clock when Mum, Dad and Charlie get home. Charlie goes straight upstairs to bed without saying anything to me. Michael and I are on the sofa in the living room and he's playing me some music on my laptop. He got it hooked up to the stereo. Piano music, or something. It's making us both doze off and I'm leaning on him, but not in a romantic way or anything. Mum and Dad sort of stop in the doorway and just stay there, blinking, paralysed. "Hello," says Michael. He jumps up and holds out a hand to Dad. "I'm Michael Holden. I'm Tori's new friend." Dad shakes it. "Michael Holden, right. Nice to meet you, Michael." Michael shakes Mum's hand as well, which I think is a bit weird. I don't know. I'm no expert on social etiquette. "Right," says Mum. "Of course, Tori's friend." "I hope it's all right that I came round," says Michael. "I met Tori a couple of weeks ago. I thought she might be a bit lonely." "Not at all," says Dad, nodding. "That's very kind of you, Michael." This conversation is so boring and cliché that I'm almost tempted to fall asleep, but I don't. Michael turns back to Dad. "I read Metamorphosis while I was here. Tori told me you lent it to her. I thought it was brilliant." "You did?" The light of literature dawns in Dad's eyes. "What did you make of it?" They carry on talking about literature while I am lying on the sofa. I see my mum stealing glances at me, as if trying to stare the truth out of me. "No," I telepathically tell her. "No, Michael is not my boyfriend. He cries at Beauty and the Beast. He taught me how to make chocolate cake. He stalked me when I went to a restaurant and pretended to forget why." Chapter 15. When I wake up, I can't remember who I am, because I'd been having some crazy dream. Soon, however, I wake up properly to find that Sunday is here. I'm still on the sofa, my phone is in my dressing gown pocket, and I look at it to check the time, 7:42 a.m. I immediately head upstairs and peer into Charlie's room. He's still asleep, obviously, and he looks so peaceful. It would be nice if he always looked like that. Yesterday, Michael Holden told me a lot of things, and one of those things was where he lives. Therefore, and I'm still not quite sure how or why this happens, something on this desolate Sunday makes me get up off the sofa and journey to his house on the dying sun. The dying sun is a clifftop overlooking the river. It is the only cliff in the county. I don't know why there is a cliff over a river, because there are never normally cliffs over rivers, except in films and abstract documentaries about places you will never go to. But the dying son is so dramatically named because if you stand facing out on the farthest point of the cliff, you are exactly opposite the sun as it sets. A couple of years back, I decided to take a walk around our town, and I remembered the long brown house that sat mere meters away from the cliff edge, like it was ready to take a leap. Maybe it is the fact that I can actually remember all this that causes me to wander up the long country lane and halt outside the brown house on the dying sun at 9 o'clock in the morning. Michael's house has a wooden gate and a wooden door and a sign on its front wall reading Jane's Cottage. It's somewhere you'd expect either a farmer or a lonely old person to live. I stand there, just outside the gate. Coming here was a mistake. An utter mistake. It's like 9 in the morning. No one is up at 9 in the morning on a Sunday. I can't just knock at someone's house. That's what you did in primary school, for God's sake. I head back down the lane. I've taken 20 steps when I hear the sound of his front door opening. Tori? I stop in the road. I shouldn't have come here. I should not have come here.
Tori, that is you, isn't it?
Very slowly, I turn around. Michael has shut the gate and is jogging down the road toward me. He stops before me and grins his dazzling grin. For a moment, I don't actually believe it's him. He is positively disheveled. His hair, usually gelled into a side part, flies around in wavy tufts, and he is wearing a truly admirable amount of clothes, including a woolly jumper and woolly socks. His glasses are slipping off his nose. He doesn't look awake, and his voice, normally so wispy, is a little hoarse.
Tori, he says, and clears his throat.
It's Tori Spring!
Why did I come here? What was I thinking? Why am I an idiot?
You came to my house, he says,
shaking his head back and forth in what can only be described as pure amazement.
I mean, I thought you might, but I didn't at the same time, you know.
I glance to one side. Sorry.
No, I'm really glad that you did, really.
I can go home. I didn't mean to.
No!
He laughs, and it's a nice laugh. He runs a hand through his hair. I've never seen him do that before. I find myself smiling back. I'm not quite sure how that happens either. A car rolls up behind us, and we quickly move to the side of the road to let it pass. The sky is still a little orange, and in every other direction except the town, all you can see are fields, many abandoned and wild, their long grass flowing like sea waves. I start to feel like I'm actually in the Pride and Prejudice film, you know? That bit at the end where they go out to that field in the mist and the sun is rising.
Would you like to go out? I say, then quickly add, today?
He is literally awestruck. Why am I an idiot?
Yes, definitely. Wow, yes, yes.
Why? I look back to the house. You have a nice house, I say. I wonder what it's like inside. I wonder who his parents are. I wonder how he's decorated his bedroom. Posters? Lights? Maybe he painted something. Maybe he has old board games stacked up on shelves. Maybe he has a beanbag. Maybe he has figurines. Maybe he has Aztec pattern bedsheets and black walls and teddies in a box and a diary under his pillow. He looks at the house, his expression suddenly downcast.
Yeah, he says. I guess.
Then he turns back to me.
But we should go out somewhere.
He quickly runs back to the gate and locks it. His hair is just hilarious, but kind of nice. I can't stop looking at it. He walks back and passes me and then turns and holds out his hand. His jumper, much too big for him, flutters around his body.
Coming?
I step toward him. And then I do something, like, really pathetic.
Your hair,
I say, lifting my hand and taking hold of a dark strand that covers his blue eye.
It's free.
I move the strand to one side. I then realize what I'm doing, jump backward, and cringe. I sort of wish I could disapparate, Harry Potter style. For what feels like an ice age, he doesn't stop looking at me with this frozen expression. And after that, I swear he goes a little red. He's still holding out his hand. So I take it, but that almost makes him jump.
Your hand is so cold, he says. Do you have any blood?
No, I say. I'm a ghost, remember? Chapter 16. Something is different in the air as we stroll down the road. We are hand in hand, but definitely not in a romantic way. Michael's face spins around and around in my mind, and I come to the conclusion that I do not know the boy walking next to me. I do not know him at all. Michael takes me to a cafe in the town named Café Rivière. It is next to the river, hence the unoriginal name, and I have been here many times before. We are the only people there, apart from the elderly French owner sweeping the floor, and we sit at a table with a gingham tablecloth and a vase of flowers by a window. Michael drinks tea. I eat a croissant. Dying, though I don't know why, to make conversation, I start with, "So, why'd you change schools?" The immediate look on his face tells me that this was not the casual question that I had intended it to be. I cringe. "Oh, sorry." "Sorry, that was nosy. You don't have to answer." For several long moments he continues to drink his tea. Then he puts down the cup and stares into the flowers between us. "No, it's fine. It's not too important." He chuckles to himself, as if remembering something. I didn't get on too well with the people there. Not teachers, not students. I thought a change of scene might do me some good. I thought maybe I'd get along better with girls or something stupid like that. He shrugs and laughs, but it's not a funny laugh. It's a different sort of laugh. "Nope. Obviously, my personality is far too fantastic for both girls and boys to handle." I don't know why, but I start to feel quite sad. It's not my normal type of sad, you know, the unnecessary and self-inflicted pity party sort of sad. But it's a sad that's kind of projected outward. "You should be on Waterloo Road or Skins or something," I say. He laughs again. "Why is that?" "Because you're..." I finish my sentence with a shrug. He replies with a smile. We are silent for several moments more. I eat. He drinks. "What are you doing next year?" I ask. It's a bit like I'm giving him an interview. But for once, I've got this odd feeling. Like I'm interested. "University?" He absently fondles his cup. "No. Yeah. No, I don't know. It's too late now anyway. The UCAS deadline was yesterday. How am I supposed to decide on a university course? Most of the time at school, I can't even decide which pen to use. I thought our school, like, makes you apply to uni in year 13, or at least apprenticeships and stuff. even if you don't accept the place in the end. He raises his eyebrows. You know, school can't really make you do anything. The truth of this statement is like a punch in the face. But why didn't you apply to a few unis anyway, just in case you decide you want to go?
Because I hate school.
This is quite loud. He starts to shake his head. The idea of having to sit in a chair for 3 years and learn about stuff that isn't going to help me in life literally disgusts me. I've always been crap at exams, and I always will be, and I hate that everyone thinks that you have to go to university to have a decent life. I sit there, dumbstruck. We say nothing for a minute or so before he finally meets my eyes. I'll probably just stick with sports, he says, calm again, with a sheepish grin. Oh, right. What do you play? Huh? What sport do you play? I'm a speed skater. Wait, what? I'm a speed skater. Like racing? On ice? Yep. I shake my head. It's like you just picked the most random sport. He nods acceptingly. I guess it is. Are you any good? There is a pause. I'm okay, he says. It has started to rain. The drops fall on the river, water meeting water, and trickle down the window like the glass is crying. Being a skater would be pretty cool, he says, but, you know, it's hard. Things like that are hard. I eat a bit more croissant. It's raining. He leans on his hand. If the sun came back out, there'd be a rainbow. It'd be beautiful. I look out the window. The sky is grey. There doesn't need to be a rainbow for it to be beautiful. The cafe owner mumbles something. An old woman with a walking stick hobbles inside and sits near us by a window. It seems to take her a great deal of effort. I notice that the flowers on our table are fake. What shall we do next? Asks Michael. I take a moment to think. They're playing The Empire Strikes Back at the cinema this afternoon, I say. You're a Star Wars fan? I fold my arms. Is that surprising? He looks at me. You're very surprising, in general. Then his expression changes. You're a Star Wars fan, he says. I frown. Yeah. And you can play the violin? Yeah. Do you like cats? I start to laugh. What in the name of fuck are you talking about? Humour me for a minute. Fine, yeah? Cats are pretty fabulous. And what's your opinion about Madonna and Justin Timberlake? Michael is a very strange person, but this conversation is advancing more and more toward the insanity line. Yeah, some of their songs are good, but please tell me what you're talking about. I'm starting to worry for your mental health. Solitaire. We both freeze, staring at each other. The Star Wars prank, the violin video, the cats. Material Girl, Justin Timberlake's Sexy Back. Are you suggesting what I think you're suggesting? What do you think I'm suggesting? Michael asks innocently. I think you're suggesting that Solitaire has something to do with me. And what do you say to that? I say that's the most hilarious thing I've heard all year. I stand up and start to put on my coat. I'm literally the dullest person on the face of the earth. That's what you think. Instead of arguing further, I ask, why are you so interested in them? He pauses and leans back again.
I don't know. I just get curious about this stuff, you know. I want to know who's doing it and why. He chuckles. I have a pretty sad life as it is. It takes a few seconds for the full impact of his final line to reach me. It's the first time I've heard Michael Holden say something like that. Like something I would say. Hey, I say. I nod at him earnestly. So do I. Before we leave the cafe, Michael buys the old woman a pot of tea. Then he takes me to the ice rink to show me how fast he can skate. It turns out he's BFFs with every single staff member. He high-fives them all on the way in, and they insist on high-fiving me as well, which is kind of weird, but also makes me feel sort of cool. Michael is an insane skater. He doesn't skate past me, he flies, and everything slows, and I watch his face turn toward me and this smile. His smile stretches outward, and then he just vanishes, leaving only dragon breath. I, comparatively, fall over 7 times. After I've been wobbling around on the ice for quite some time, he decides to take pity and skate with me. I clutch his hands, trying not to fall flat on my face, as he skates backward, pulling me along and laughing so hard at my concentration face that tiny tears emerge out of the corners of his eyes. Once I get the hang of things, we figure skate round the rink to Radio People by Zapp, an underrated 80s gem and coincidentally my favourite song from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. On the way out, after an hour or so, he shows me the picture of him on the skating club board, aged 10, holding a trophy high above his head. There's no one in town apart from a few oldies. Sleepy Sunday. We visit all the antiques shops. I play on a second-hand violin, and I manage to remember a surprisingly large number of pieces. Michael joins in on a piano, and we jam until the shop owners decide we're too annoying and chuck us out. In another shop, we find this amazing kaleidoscope. It's wooden and slides outward like a telescope, and we take it in turns gazing at the patterns until Michael decides to buy it. It's expensive too. I ask him why he bought it. He says because he didn't like the thought of no one ever looking into it. We walk along the river and throw stones in and play poo sticks on the bridge. We go back to Café Rivière for a late lunch and more tea for Michael. We go to the cinema to see The Empire Strikes Back, which, of course, is excellent. And then we hang around to watch Dirty Dancing, because apparently it's back to the 80s day. Dirty Dancing is a very stupid film. The main girl is probably the most irritating individual I have ever had the misfortune to encounter. Mostly due to her outfits and her voice. Midway through the film, I get another message on my blog. Anonymous, thought for the day. Why do people leave newspapers on trains? I show this one to Michael. What a fantastic question, he says. I fail to see how it's a fantastic question, so I delete it, just like I did the other. I don't know what the time is, but it's getting dark now. We go back to the dying sun. A little farther along the cliff is Michael's house, glowing against the sky. This clifftop really is the best place in the world. The best end of the universe. We balance on the edge, letting the wind flow past our ears. I dangle my legs off, and after some persuasion, so does he. The sun's setting, he says. The sun also rises, I say before I can stop myself. His head turns like a robot. Say that again. What? Say that again. Say what? What you just said? I sigh. The sun also rises. And who, might I ask, wrote that literary jewel? I sigh again. Ernest Hemingway. He starts shaking his head.
You hate literature. You hate it. You can't even bring yourself to read Pride and Prejudice.
Name three other Hemingway novels.
Really? You're really going to ask me to do that?
He smiles. I roll my eyes.
For Whom the Bell Tolls, The Old Man and the Sea, A Farewell to Arms.
His mouth opens in astonishment.
It's not like I've read any of them.
Now I'm going to have to test you.
Jesus!
Who wrote The Bell Jar?
Don't pretend you don't know it, Spring.
That's the first time he's called me by my surname only. I'm not sure what this says about our relationship.
Fine, Sylvia Plath.
Who wrote The Catcher in the Rye?
J.D. Salinger, you're giving me really easy ones.
Okay, then. Who wrote Endgame?
Samuel Beckett.
A Room of One's Own?
Virginia Woolf.
He gives me a long look before.
The Beautiful and Damned.
I want to stop myself saying the answers, but I can't. I can't lie to him.
F. Scott Fitzgerald.
He shakes his head.
You know all the names to books, but you haven't read a single one. It's like it's raining money, but you refuse to catch a single coin.
I know that if I persisted past the first few pages, I would probably enjoy some books. But I don't. I can't read books, because I know that none of it is real.
Yeah, I'm a hypocrite. Films aren't real. But I love them.
But books, they're different.
When you watch a film, you're sort of an outsider looking in.
With a book, you're right there. You are inside. You are the main character.
A minute later, he asks, Have you ever had a boyfriend, Tori?
I snort.
Clearly not.
Don't say that. You're a sexy beast. You could easily have had a boyfriend.
I am not a sexy beast in any way whatsoever. I put on an accent.
I'm a strong, independent woman who don't need no man.
This actually makes Michael laugh so hard that he has to roll over and hide his face in his hands, which makes me laugh too. We continue laughing hysterically until the sun is almost completely gone. Once we calm down, Michael lies back in the grass.
I hope you don't mind me saying, but Becky doesn't really seem to hang around you much at school. I mean, if you didn't know, you wouldn't guess that you were best friends.
He looks at me. You don't really talk to each other very much.
I cross my legs. Another sudden topic change.
Yeah, she... I don't know. Maybe that's why we are best friends, because we don't need to talk much anymore.
I look back at him, stretched out. His arm is laid over his forehead. His hair is splayed out in the dark, and the remaining light swells in kaleidoscope shapes in his blue eye. I look away. She has a lot more friends than me, I guess. But that's all right. I don't mind. It's understandable. I'm quite boring. I mean, she'd have a really boring life if she just hung around with me all the time.
You're not boring. You're the epitome of not boring.
Pause.
I think you're a really good friend, he says.
I turn again. He smiles at me, and it reminds me of his expression when he walked through C16's door that day. Wild. Shining. Something not quite reachable about it.
Becky is really lucky to have someone like you.
I would be nothing without Becky, I think. Even though things are different now. Sometimes it makes me tear up thinking about how much I love her. It's the other way round, I say. The clouds have mostly cleared now. The sky is orange at the horizon, leading up to a dark blue above our heads. It looks like a portal. I start thinking about the Star Wars film we watched earlier. I wanted to be a Jedi so badly when I was a kid. My lightsaber would have been green. I should go home, I say eventually. I didn't tell my parents I was going out. Ah, right. We both stand up. I'll walk home with you. You really don't have to. But he does anyway. Chapter 17. When we arrive outside my house, the sky is black and there are no stars. Michael turns and puts his arms around me. It takes me by surprise, so I don't have time to react, and my arms are once again trapped at my sides. I had a really good day, he says, holding me. So did I. He lets go. Do you think we're friends now? I hesitate. I can't think why. I hesitate for no reason. I will regret the conversation that occurs next for the rest of my life. It's like, I say, you really want to be friends with me. He looks slightly embarrassed, almost apologetic. It's like you're doing it for yourself, I say. All friendships are selfish. Maybe if we were all selfless, we would leave each other alone. Sometimes that's better. This hurts him. I shouldn't have said it. I'm pushing his temporary happiness out. Is it? I don't know why I can't just say that we're friends and be done with it. What is this, whole thing? I meet you, like, 2 weeks ago. None of this makes any sense. I don't understand why you want to be friends with me. That's what you said last time. Last time? Why are you making this so complicated? We're not 6 years old. I say, I'm just awful at... I don't know. His mouth turns down. I don't know what to say, I say. It's all right. He takes off his glasses to wipe them with his jumper sleeve. I've never seen him without his glasses on. It's fine. And then as he replaces his glasses, all the sadness disintegrates, and what's left underneath is the real Michael. The fire. The boy who skates. The boy who followed me to a restaurant to tell me something he couldn't remember. The boy who has nothing better to do than force me to get out of the house and live. Is it time for me to give up? He asks, and then answers. No, it's not. You sound like you're in love with me, I say, for God's sake. There is no reason why I couldn't be in love with you. You implied that you are gay. That's entirely subjective. Are you then? Am I gay? Are you in love with me? He winks. It's a mystery. I'm going to take that as a no. Of course you are. Of course you're going to take that as a no. You didn't even need to ask me that question, did you? He's annoying me now, a lot. Jesus fucking Christ. I know I'm a stupid, twattish pessimist, but stop acting like I'm some kind of manically depressed psychopath. And then suddenly, like a wind change or a bump in the road, or the moment that makes you scream in a horror film, suddenly he's an entirely different person. His smile dies, and the blue and green of his eyes darken. He clenches his fist and he snarls. He actually snarls at me. Maybe you are a manically depressed psychopath. I freeze, stunned, wanting to be sick. Fine. I turn around and go into the house and shut the door.
Charlie is at Nick's for once. I go to his room and lie down. He has a world map next to his bed, with certain places circled. Prague, Kyoto, Seattle. There are also several pictures of him with Nick. Nick and Charlie in the London Eye. Nick and Charlie at a rugby match. Nick and Charlie at the beach. His bedroom is so tidy. Obsessively tidy. It smells of cleaning spray. I look at the book he's reading, which is beside his pillow. It's called Less Than Zero, and is by Bret Easton Ellis. Charlie talked to me about it once. He said that he liked it because it's the sort of book that makes you understand people a little better. And he also said it helped him understand me a little better. I didn't really believe him because I think that novels can very easily brainwash people. And apparently, Bret Easton Ellis is infamous on Twitter. In his bedside table is a drawer that used to have all these chocolate bars stacked and ordered inside. But Mum found them and threw them away a few weeks before he had to go to the hospital the first time. Now there are lots of books in the drawer. A lot that Dad's obviously given to him. I shut the drawer. I go get my laptop and bring it into Charlie's room and scroll through some blogs. I've ruined it, haven't I? I'm angry that Michael said that stuff. I hate that he said that stuff. But I said stupid stuff too. I sit and wonder whether Michael is going to talk to me tomorrow. This is probably my fault. Everything is my fault. I wonder how much Becky will talk about Ben tomorrow. A lot. I think about who else I could hang around with. There isn't anyone. I think about how I do not want to leave this house ever again. I think about whether I had any homework to do this weekend. I think about what a dreadful person I am. I put on Amelie, which is the best foreign film in the history of cinema. I tell you, this is one of the original indie films. It gets romance right. You can tell that it's genuine. It's not just like, she's pretty, he's handsome, they both hate each other, then they realise there's another side to both of them. They start to like each other, love declaration, the end. Amelie's romance is meaningful. It's not fake. It's believable. It's real. I go downstairs. Mum is on the computer. I tell her good night, but it takes her at least 20 seconds to hear me. So I just head back upstairs with a glass of diet lemonade. Chapter 18. Becky is with Ben Hope at school. They are together now. They're together in the common room, and they're smiling a lot. After I've been sitting nearby on a swivel chair for several minutes, Becky finally notices that I'm here. Hey! Becky beams at me, but the greeting sounds forced. Morning. Becky and Ben are also sitting, Becky's legs up on Ben's lap. I don't think I've spoken to you before, says Ben. He is so attractive that I feel extra awkward. I hate that. What's your name? Tori Spring, I say. I'm in your maths and English. Oh, right, yeah, I thought I'd seen you. I don't think he's seen me. Yeah, I'm Ben. Yeah? We sit there for a bit, him expecting me to continue the conversation. He clearly does not know me well. Wait, Tori Spring? He squints at me. Are you Charlie Spring's sister? Yeah. Charlie Spring, who goes out with Nick Nelson? Yeah. Instantly, all traces of smarminess drop from his face, leaving only a kind of strangled anxiety. For a moment, it's almost as if he's searching for some reaction from me. But then it's gone. Cool, yeah, I saw him around at Truham. I nod. Cool.
You knew Charlie Spring? Asks Becky.
Ben fiddles with his shirt buttons. Not closely, just saw him around, you know, small world, innit?
Yeah, I say, and then mutter, innit?
Becky is staring at me with a strange expression. I stare back at her, trying to telepathically tell her that I don't want to be here.
Tori, says Becky, did you do the sociology homework?
Yeah, did you?
She grins sheepishly and glances sideways at Ben. They exchange a cheeky look.
We were busy, she giggles.
I try not to think about the connotations of the word busy. Evelyn has been here the whole time, faced away from us, chatting to some other year 12s who I don't talk to. At this point, she spins around on her chair, rolls her eyes at Ben and Becky, and says,
Ugh, why are you guys so adorable?
I look at her. She has a very peculiar hairstyle today, which only emphasizes her hipster originality. She is wearing chunky earrings and her nails are black. I know that it shouldn't matter what you look like or how you dress yourself, and I try very hard not to judge her. But I am a very bad person, so I fail miserably. I rummage around in my bag, find my homework, and give it to Becky. Just give it back in sociology, I say.
Aw, she takes a piece of paper. You are fabulous. Thanks, hun.
Becky has never called me hun in my entire life. She has called me man. She has called me mate. She has called me dude 100 billion times. But she has never, ever called me hun. The bell goes, and I leave without saying bye. Lucas comes up to me at break while I'm sorting out my books at my locker. He tries to start a conversation, and, to be fair, just because I feel sorry for him most of the time, I try really hard to talk to him. By try really hard, I mean that I don't just ignore him. I feel like his hair has grown since Friday. We get talking about Becky's party.
Yeah, I went home kind of early, he says. You sort of disappeared halfway through.
I wonder if he saw me with Michael.
Yeah,
I say, looking briefly at him with one hand on my locker door.
I went home too.
He nods at me and puts his hands in his trouser pockets. But I can tell. I can tell that he knows I didn't go home. There's a short silence before he quickly moves on.
I don't know if she liked my present, he says with a shrug. Then he looks at me. I was always really good at buying presents for you.
I nod. This is true.
Yeah, you were.
April 5th, yeah? He remembers my birthday. I turn away, taking longer than I need to retrieve my maths textbook.
Well remembered.
Another awkward pause.
Mine's October, he says.
He's already 17 then.
I thought you might not remember.
I'm not very good at remembering stuff.
Yeah,
no, it's fine. He laughs. I start to feel a little dazed. When the bell finally goes for period 3, the relief almost makes me pass out. By 4th period, solitaire has struck again. The only website that the school computers are now able to access is a solitaire blog, which is currently displaying a large photo of a topless Jake Gyllenhaal beneath the following words. Solitarians, we have reached 2,000 followers. Your reward is the destruction of all of today's IT lessons at Higgs, a la Gyllenhaal. For those of you who do not attend Higgs, we are sure you will appreciate the Gyllenhaal regardless. Patience kills. The teachers are practically hurling people out of the computer rooms, and all IT lessons are cancelled until further notice. I applaud Solitaire for its efforts. Kent has decided to take things up a notch, and I don't blame him. At the start of lunch, I find myself walking into the sixth form office for a student interview, which is teacher lingo for interrogation. Kent's there at his computer, and Strasser's there too, blinking enthusiastically. I slump into a chair. On the wall opposite, there is a poster that reads, "Talk helps." This is very, very pointless.
"We won't keep you long," says Strasser. "This is a safe space. Anything you say in this room will remain anonymous."
Kent gives Strasser this look.
"We just want to know if you've seen or heard anything that might be of any help," he says.
"No," I say, even though there's the messages and the C-13 hack and the meetup. "Sorry, nothing." I know that this is a lie, and I do not know why I lied. I just feel that if I say something about what I've seen and heard, that will make me involved, and I do not like being involved.
"Fine," says Kent. "Just be on the lookout. I know you're not a prefect, but, you know."
I nod and get up to leave.
"Tori," says Kent.
I turn around. He gives me a look, a different look, but then it's gone.
"Be alert," he says. "We can't have things getting any worse."
I'm scrolling through a blog in the common room at the end of lunch when our lot enter and sit at a table, having just come back from the cafeteria. Today, that's Becky and Lauren and Rita. No Lucas or Evelyn. I forgot to make myself a lunch, and I don't have any money. But to be honest, the thought of food is making me feel slightly ill. Becky sees me at the computers and comes over. I exit the blog and put up an English essay I haven't finished.
"Why are you here by yourself?"
"I haven't done that English essay."
"What English essay? I thought we had that other homework."
"The mini essay, The Heroes in Pride and Prejudice, it's due tomorrow."
"Oh, yeah, that's so not happening. I've started to realise that I'd much rather live my life than do work."
I nod as if I understand. "Fair enough. You saw my Facebook update, yeah?"
"Yeah."
She sighs and puts her hands on her cheeks.
"I'm just so happy. I can't even believe it. He's like the nicest guy I have ever met."
I nod and smile. "I'm so happy for you." I keep on nodding and smiling.
"Like, on Saturday I texted him, like, 'Did you mean all the things you said at my party? Or was it just the drink talking?' And he was like, 'No, I meant everything. I really like you.'"
"That's cute."
"I really like him as well."
"Good." She takes out her phone and scrolls through it and then waves it around and laughs.
"I haven't been this happy in ages."
I hold my hands together in my lap. "I'm really glad for you, Becky."
"Hee hee, thanks."
We don't say anything for a few seconds. We just smile.
"What did you do this weekend?"
she asks, out of obligation. I run my hand through my hair. A strand had been flicked over the wrong side.
"Nothing, you know me."
She keeps eye contact.
"I think you could be a lot more outgoing than you are. You just, like, don't try. If you tried, you could get a boyfriend really easily."
"I don't really need a boyfriend," I say. After a little while, the bell goes for afternoon form, and I wonder whether there's even any point me turning up, seeing as my form tutor really does keep marking me as late in the register. I've finished and printed that essay. Everyone goes off to their form groups except me. I start walking to my form room, but when I turn right, Michael walks past me, and seeing him makes me want to start kicking and punching things. He stops and asks,
Where are you going? But I just walk out of the school gate and keep on walking. There is barely anyone in our dying town, and it's literally Arctic temperatures. But I left my coat at school, and when I finally get home, I am totally alone. So I get into bed and sleep until Mum wakes me for dinner, not having any idea that I ran away from school. That evening, Charlie has an appointment with his psychiatrist at the hospital, and we all decide to go. Mum, Dad, and me. So we leave Oliver at home with Nick babysitting. Mum and Dad go in for a meeting first, leaving Charlie and me to wait in the visiting room. This is the first time I've been to the hospital since Charlie stayed here last year, and it's still just as creepily optimistic. On the wall, there is a big painting of a rainbow and the sun with a smiley face. The adolescent ward has patients with every type of mental illness. Currently with us in the room is an anorexic girl reading The Hunger Games, and the irony of this is too cruel to laugh at. There is also a younger boy, perhaps 13, watching Shrek and cackling manically at everything Donkey says. Charlie has not talked to me since Friday, but I haven't talked to him either. After several minutes, he breaks our silence. Why haven't we been talking? He's wearing a loose-fitting check shirt and jeans. His eyes are dark and dead. I don't know, is all I can say. You're angry at me. I'm definitely not. You should be. I fold my legs up on the sofa. It's not like it's your fault. Then whose fault is it? He leans on one hand. Who is responsible for this? No one, I snap. Shit happens. Shit happens to the wrong people. You know that. He looks at me for a long time, head slightly lowered. He's holding onto his shirt sleeves, so I can't see his wrists. What have you been up to? He asks. I pause before telling him. I was with Michael Holden all weekend. He raises his eyebrows. Not like that, I say. Well, I didn't say anything. Bet you were thinking it. Why were you with him all weekend? Are you friends now? His eyes glimmer. I didn't think you did that. I frown. He told me I was a manically depressed psychopath. I don't think he... The water machine bubbles. The windows are open a crack, and they are rattling the 1980s blinds. Charlie looks at me. What else is happening? He asks. We haven't talked properly in ages. I list the things. Becky is going out with Ben Hope. She talks about him all the time. I haven't talked to Mum and Dad properly since Saturday. I haven't been sleeping a lot. And Michael. Charlie nods. That's a lot of things. I know, a real array of first world problems. In the corridor outside the visiting lounge, the emergency alarm begins to sound, signifying that somewhere in the building a patient needs to be restrained. I watch through the blinds as a girl runs past, wailing, only to be pursued and leapt on by three large care assistants. It's almost comical. Charlie doesn't even blink. Hang on, he says. Becky is going out with Ben Hope. Yeah? Ben Hope, who used to go to Truam. What, do you know him? The question almost appears to startle him. After a short pause, he says, Yeah, we used to be friends. Not really anymore, though. Okay. I'm staying off school tomorrow as well. Yeah? Yeah. Mum and Dad are making me. They're blowing this kind of out of proportion. I snort. I found you in the kitchen covered in blood, idiot. He leans back. Well, aren't I a fabulous drama queen? Do you want me to get the bus with you on Wednesday?
Usually I walk to school and Charlie gets the bus. I hate the bus. Charlie's expression softens and he smiles. Yeah, thanks. He adjusts himself on the sofa so that his body is facing me. I think you should give Michael a chance.
A chance?
I know Nick and I said he's weird, and he is weird, and I know you think that it's easier to be by yourself. But every minute you spend thinking about what you're not doing, that's another minute forgetting about how to be around other people.
I don't.
Michael's okay. He's proven that. I don't understand why you can't accept things like this. If you can't accept things you don't understand, then you'll spend your life questioning everything. Then you'll have to live out your life in your own head. We're interrupted by a nurse, who enters the room and asks Charlie to join Mum and Dad in the meeting. Charlie stands up but doesn't walk off. He looks down at me. Is that a bad thing? I ask. He blinks slowly, eyes flickering to the anorexic reading The Hunger Games. Victoria, that is how you end up in a place like this. Chapter 19. The fire alarm goes off in period 5 the next day. I had just settled into a seat in the common room, iPod playing Fix You by Coldplay, over and over on repeat. Pathetic, I know. When the siren began to wail. Now we're all here in the freezing wasteland of the school field, lined up in our form groups. I hear at least 3 people say something about a fire in Kent's office. But having been at an all-girls school for over 5 years, I've learnt not to trust anything by word of mouth. No one I really know is in my form. So I shiver and look around. I see Michael in a form a few lines away, sort of out of place among the year 13s. He looks sort of out of place everywhere. I start to wonder whether my outburst on Sunday is the reason why he hasn't called me or looked for me at school. I wonder whether he'll still want to be friends. Maybe I should listen to Charlie. If he thinks that Michael is okay, then he probably is. And I should give him a chance. Not that that matters, because I declined his offer anyway. It's not like he's going to give me another chance. That's okay, that's fine. I don't want to go to that solitaire meetup this Saturday, so I've at least gotten out of that. I keep looking at him because there's something not quite right. With half-shut eyes, he's staring blankly into a book, and his face is so frozen that it makes me tense up. In fact, I almost think he's about to cry. I can't quite see what the book is called, but it's very thick and he's nearly at the end. Also, his tie isn't tied. He's wrapped it around his neck like a scarf, and his side part is much too far over. I wish I knew what he was reading. I know I don't like books, but you can always tell what someone is thinking by what they're reading. A little way off, Lucas wanders onto the field with Evelyn and an anonymous boy with large hair, part of the last group to arrive. Lucas looks equally sad. I begin to feel that everyone is sad. Everything is sad. All sad. I wonder whether Lucas is Evelyn's secret boyfriend. It's possible. I don't want to think about Lucas or Michael anymore. I withdraw my phone and load up the solitaire blog. I can at least have another look at Jake Gyllenhaal. He is a beautiful human being. But there's a new post that's overtaken Jake. It's a photo of a hand, maybe a girl's, but potentially a boy's, forefinger outstretched, just about to break the glass of a school fire alarm button. Underneath, the text reads, "Do I dare disturb the universe?" I stare at the photo for a long time and I start to feel a bit claustrophobic. That question, those 2 lines of poetry, keep spinning around my head like it's asking it of me. I get to wondering how I even know that those 2 lines came from a poem, because I don't think I've even glanced at a poem that hasn't been part of schoolwork.
I then wonder whether I could ask Michael, because he would probably know what poem it was from. But then I remember that he thinks I'm a manically depressed psychopath. So that is the end of that. Chapter 20. I get home. Everything normal happens. I say hello to Nick and Charlie. I turn on my laptop. I put a film on. And then I do something weird. I call Michael. 16:49 p.m. Outgoing call. M. Hello? T. Hi, it's Tori. M. Tori? Really? You called me again? That's twice in a fortnight. You do not strike me as one who enjoys making phone calls. T. Believe me, I'm not. M. T. I overreacted. I'm the one who has to say sorry. I called to say sorry. M. T. M. I'm sorry too. I don't think you're a psychopath. T. Don't you? It's a valid assumption. M. I don't even know why we need to apologize to each other. I can't even remember what we're arguing about. I don't even think we did argue. T. Are you in denial? M. Are you? T. What does that mean? M. I don't know. T. I'm just sorry I snapped at you. M. T. I do want to be friends with you. Can we? M. We're already friends, Tori. You don't need to ask. We're already friends. T. M. Is Charlie all right? T. He's all right. M. Are you all right? T. I'm fine. M. T. M. I see Becky and Ben are pretty snug together. T. Oh, yeah, they're practically conjoined. She's really happy. M. Are you happy? T. What? M. Are you happy? T. Yeah, I'm happy for her. I'm happy for her. She's my best friend. I'm really happy for her. M. That's not what I asked. T. I don't get it. M. T. M. Will you still come to the solitaire meetup with me on Saturday? T. M. I don't want to go alone. T. Yeah. M. You'll come? T. Yes. M. T. Why can I hear wind? Where are you? M. I'm at the rink. T. The ice rink? M. Do you know any other rinks? T. You're on the phone and skating at the same time. M. Men can multitask too, you know. Where are you? T. Obviously at home. M. Such a loser. T. What's that music that's playing? M. T. That's film music, isn't it? M. Is it? T. It's from Gladiator. It's called Now We Are Free. M. T. M. Your film knowledge is simply magical. T. Magical? M. You're magical, Tori. T. You're the one who can ice skate. That's the closest thing to flying a human can do without a vehicle. M. T. You can fly, Michael. M. T. What? M. I can fly. T. You can fly. M. No one's ever. T. M.
I'd better meet you at Hogwarts then.
T.
Or Neverland.
M.
Or both.
T.
Or both.
Chapter 21. Sitting next to Charlie on the Wednesday morning bus journey calms me. I have a lot of unread messages on my blog, but I don't want to read them. It's much, much too sunny today. We meet Nick outside Truam. Nick gives Charlie a quick kiss, and they start talking to each other, laughing. I watch him and Charlie walk in, and then head up the road to Higgs. I'm feeling sort of all right because Michael and I are okay now. I don't know why I made all that fuss the other day. No, that's a lie. I do know why. It's because I'm an idiot. Mr. Compton, my unintelligible imbecile of a maths teacher, decides, for one lesson only, that we need to work in pairs with people we do not usually sit with. This is how I end up sitting next to Ben Hope in Wednesday's Period 1 maths lesson. We exchange pleasantries and then sit in silence while Compton begins to explain the trapezium rule in the most complicated way imaginable. Ben does not have a pencil case. He carries a pen and a small ruler in his breast pocket. He has also forgotten his textbook. I feel that this may have been deliberate. Halfway through, Compton leaves to photocopy some sheets and does not return for some time. To my dismay, Ben decides that he needs to talk to me. "Hey," he says, "how's Charlie doing?" I turn my head slowly to the left. Surprisingly, he looks genuinely concerned.
Truth? Lie?
"Not too bad," Ben nods.
"Yeah, okay.
Charlie said you used to be friends or something."
His eyes open very wide.
Yeah, I guess, but, you know, like, yeah, everyone knows Charlie, you know?
"Yeah, everyone knows. You don't stay off school for 3 months without everyone finding out why."
"Yeah."
The silence between us returns. The rest of our class are chattering and it is nearly the end of the lesson. Has Compton been eaten by the photocopier? I suddenly find myself talking. Talking first. This is pretty rare. "Everyone loves Charlie at Truam," I say, "don't they?" Ben begins to tap his pen on the table. A weirdly nervous grin spreads across his face.
"Well, I wouldn't say everyone exactly," he scoffs.
I frown at him and he quickly covers himself with,
"No, I mean, like, people can't be liked by everyone, right?"
I clear my throat. "I guess not."
"I don't know him anymore, really," he says.
"Yeah, okay." Usually people like Charlie, nice people, are forgotten. Usually the popular people are the loudest and funniest, the ones with the opinions, with the outfits, with the big smiles and crushing hugs. Nice people are vulnerable because they don't know how to be mean. They don't know how to put themselves at the top. And you would think that it would be someone like Nick who is at the top at Truam. Loud, attractive, house captain, rugby player. But no, it's Charlie. What I'm trying to say is that Charlie is a nice person. And despite everything I've just explained, everybody seems to love him. And I think that is a modern miracle. Chapter 22. Lunch. Common room. I am staring into my reflection in a smudgy blank computer screen with my head in my hands. Not because I'm particularly stressed or anything. This is just a very comfortable sitting position.
"Hello," says Lucas, smiling and sitting in the chair next to me. I look up at him. He doesn't look so embarrassed today, which is colossal progress.
"Why so cheerful?" I ask.
He shrugs.
"Why not?
I roll my eyes, faking sarcasm. I don't like your attitude. He stares at me for a minute.